The Disciplined Investor Podcast is underwritten by Interactive Brokers. Savvy investors use portfolio analysts to create a consolidated view of their finances and check the health of their complete financial portfolio. Sign up for free at portfolioanalyst.com.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Friday was the best final hour surge for markets in months and months. Yields take a breather at end of the quarter, which benefits fixed income. And it's a celebration of our 14th year anniversary show. Our good friend Vitaly Katsinelson is our guest and bringing back the first guest we ever had on the show. All this and much more on episode number 707 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a very good day to you. Happy Passover for all that are celebrating this fine holiday. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and so glad that you are joining me today. Yeah, we have a busy show today. As I mentioned at the top there, we have two guests. And I thought we'd get to the bottom also of the definition today of what is a value stock. We've been hearing more and more about this as they've been leading the markets tremendously this year, as back part of last year, but more so this year, and this move has been pretty significant. So I thought that we would bring back Vitaly and talk about that because he's a guru in the area of value stocks. Get to the bottom of what he thinks really is the definition and how to find those. And as I mentioned, we're going to bring back a guest. I'm not going to tell you his name yet. Celebrating where it all began back in 2007. With the first guest ever on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Before we do that, I want to talk about a topic I think is pretty important right now. I think last week we talked about this on DH Unplugged. This week also had some discussion, this idea of what was going on with yields with regard to bonds, the supplemental leverage ratio, the SLR, which we saw a final resolution of that by the Fed last week, talking about how they are going to end the program on March 31st, as planned. It was planned. This is what they were doing. And now that was, I think, a relief for markets to a degree. Some of the thought that many of the primary dealers, banks, would have to sell their bonds. And there was a lot of bond selling. About $80 billion worth of bonds was sold. And that did, in fact, bring rates up. But we know that the Fed is still buying $120 billion of total bonds per month, $80 billion of treasuries, $40 billion of mixed in the area of corporates and munis. So they're still at it. Their balance sheet is bigger than ever. Let's take a look at that. It's in multiple trillions of dollars. Highest level, they're continuing to buy. They're not stopping anytime soon. But there was something else going on right now. You know, right now we saw that one of the things that have been happening that has been important to markets is the move on rates. Bonds have been, the yields have been driving higher. We started the year in 2021 at about 1%, sub 1%, actually 0.93 when I last looked at it. And we hit a high of 1.7% or so in 2021. That's a pretty significant move. Now, when we have those kinds of moves, and when we see the impact on stocks, and again, something we've talked about, we have to look at what else is going on. And right now, there was a study that was put out by JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs this week that I think was really important because it talks about how much is going to be required over the next several weeks to rebalance portfolios that are considered allocated and fixed allocation, you know, the old 60-40, 50-50, 70-30 kind of move of balanced fund and some of the sovereign wealth funds, some of the hedge funds, some of the institutions out there, pension funds. And what happens is that they're going to have a requirement to rebalance. And as bonds have not done well throughout the year so far, this quarter is going to see upwards of about a $500 billion move from stocks to bonds. And that's going to take place over the next week or so. And it's going to benefit bonds. In other words, it's going to take rates down and possibly temporarily and maybe even hurt some of the best performing equity sectors as money is moving out of it in a big way back into bonds. And this is a pretty big rebalance by historical metrics and something to be aware of. I think that's going to keep a lid on rates for a little while here, and that's probably why we saw rates starting to drop at the mid part of last week from 1.7 down to 1.6 or change. Kicked up a little bit on Friday, but it's going to keep a lid on rates for a little while. Now, with that in mind, we have to also consider, once this is over, what happens. So what I want you to do is put a pin on the calendar, second week of April, and let's take a look again at what's happening with rates. And if we go back to the increasing environment, because we're seeing the economy do much better, even though we know the Fed is going to keep the gas pressed down to the floor, the pedal is going to be to the metal, and we're going to have to watch that carefully. All right, with that, again, we have a very busy show today, so we're going to get to our first guest. And you know, it is 14 years, as we've talked about that. We've been doing this great podcast, The Disciplined Investor. And I look back and I wondered, hey, what could we do for 14 years, 700 plus episodes to commemorate this time? And I thought, hey, you know what? Let's go back and look for who was that first guest that we had on episode, one of the first episodes. I don't know if it was episode one or two or three, whatever. It was one of the first episodes. Look back, and there I found Brian Freeman. And you know what? We got him back today to talk about what's gone on over the last decade and a half almost. Brian, how are you?
I'm fantastic. Happy 14th anniversary.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a long
this
ride.
This is great.
It's been
wow, how many 700 plus shows?
Yep. What's amazing?
Who does that?
Who does that kind of, what kind of crazy man does that? You know, it's interesting because I look back on all these years and yeah. I look at the progression and the advancement and all the things that have happened with not only the technology, but the incredible amount of adoption of podcasts as a real medium. Back then it was like, what's a podcast? Right. Mm-hmm. And yep. And you were in radio and you're probably like, oh, it's a podcast. It's a fading thing. Maybe it's something. It's a bunch of amateurs doing their thing. But boy, it's changed. What's gone on in the last 14 years in your world?
Well, my world really changed dramatically after you and I talked. When we spoke 14 years ago, I was en route to North Carolina to work for Curtis Media. I couldn't say who the company was at the time. I did end up working there for 8.5 years. I worked at WSJS in Winston-Salem. I was the morning guy. I was the program director or the news director. We had four stations in our group. And after 2.5 years, I was promoted over to the Raleigh headquarters and made the morning man a 50,000 watt WPTF. You talk about a historic radio station with lineage that goes back into the 1920s and reaching 18 states with his signal.
Wow.
And I had an honor of being there for nearly almost 6 years on the air there. I was also, when I first was hired for that position, I was made the program director. And within about a half a year, the news director. The complication with the industry, I was right in the middle of it, and that was the downsizing by many and the wearing of hats by many more.
Mm.
And yeah, I'm sure you know what that means.
Yeah, every
and I ended up with that. I ended up with that. So after my 8.5 years there, I walked into WPTF again as with three job titles. When I departed at the end of 2015, I had 8 job titles, including the head of their 100 station statewide news network. I was in charge of all of their talk stations. It is a great company. It's owned by one person. It's not a not owned by a big corporation or anything. Right. Don Curtis owns it. Mm-hmm. He believes in AM radio, and a lot of his stations are AM. He has some super powerhouse FMs. But anywho, had a great time there. It was a lot of hours, a lot of work. On a personal side, shortly after we talked, with my pending move to North Carolina, my wife of 20 years decided she didn't want to be married anymore.
Oh.
And moved to North Carolina. So that ended. But not long afterward, I met a young lady. Her name is Susie. And we were married 5 years to the day after we met. And we met on an airplane one weekend when I was flying to Florida to see my kids with their mom.
Wow.
And so we're almost at 14 years together, and I think 9 married. And she's a Southern girl, just like my mama was. And we just have a grand old time. So anywho, the end of 2015, when I left there, we moved to Cape Coral, Florida, where we had a little vacation house. And I got a part-time job working at the number one station here, Wink Television and 92.5 Fox News, Sun Broadcasting and Fort Myers Broadcasting. Great folks. And I did morning news. So I was done at 9 o'clock in the morning. I went home, and so I was kind of semi-retired. And in 2019, at the end of 2019, I was about to turn 62, and I decided to call the ball and retired.
That's
and
it.
That's it. I mean, I have things to do. I'm a Lionel train collector. I have a huge collection of 1949 to 1969 wow. Lionel trains. And in fact, I'm sitting in the train room right now. So I've been able to rediscover my my childhood.
I had, let's see, there was HOs. I think I had HOs.
Yeah.
Those are the bigger ones, right?
No, actually, they're not. The Gs are the real big ones, the garden scale, the ones you see out in somebody's yard.
Right.
Then you have O scale, which is the Lionel.
Right.
You remember, maybe remember it as a kid as O27. It was a little bit smaller than the O gauge. Then there is HO. Below that is N gauge. I have some of that.
I have the N gauge. Those are the little bitty ones,
you have
right?
N gauge? Do you really?
I had those. I have, oh, wait. Oh, no, I'm not in the right place. And my other, well, you know, I have something here. Keep talking. I'm going to grab it. Keep talking.
Yeah. So anyway, you have your HO, your N, to the side is American Flyer, which is S, and then there's even, I believe, a Z scale, which are so small that I probably would have to use tweezers to pick it up and operate it. So I like what I'm doing with my Lionel. I get to work on them. I get creative with it, so my creative side gets to come out.
I have in front of me, what does it say here? Built by Lionel, Michigan Central. Looks like a coal carrier.
All right.
Does it say what gauge it is on here? Let's see. MCRR. Nah. I think this is the HOs.
It probably was.
It's like 6 inches long, this car.
Yep, that would be HO. If it's 9, it's probably O. Funny enough, I'm sitting next to a 1962 dealer platform that my dad won from a store in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania when I was 10. And I redid it. And it was the second year that Lionel promoted not only their O gauge, but a little circle elevated around the center of the platform was to introduce Lionel HO. So you're not far off. It probably is Lionel HO. It went dead for a number of years, and they brought it back. And you want to talk about a success story. Lionel, now based in Charlotte, North Carolina, just outside Charlotte, has geared its business not only to the young consumer. Polar Express put them back on the map because of the Polar Express chains, but they also gear custom-made engines to the older folks like me who have that extra income for a really great engine. You can pay upwards of $1,500 to $2,000 for a Lionel engine, and they are beautiful.
Do you sit there with like a conductor hat on and put the thing on and get the smoke coming out and go in and out of the tunnels and around?
Yes, without the conductor's hat. And I have a West Highland White Terrier that is nuts about these trains, and part of our daily routine is coming in and running the trains, and she will bug me until I come in. She has a little chair that she gets in and watches it. It's a two-level system. So she watches them. If one stops, she starts barking.
Oh, it's like an alarm system. It's like a track alert.
Yes.
Track alert. We're off track.
I believe she thinks she's the conductor.
Yep. Speaking about being off track, let's get back on track. Let's talk about some of the trends in media. I mean, right now, everybody has a podcast, right? Everybody is a podcaster, and it seems that we have a really interesting environment right now. What is the and we have Spotify, and we have Sirius, and we have Amazon and Apple, and the list goes on and on of where these podcasts are held. What is the view of terrestrial radio? Probably some of the younger people don't even know what that means. But what's the view of the AM, the FM, the dial moving forward?
I'm going to surprise you. I'll give you some current facts. The number of radio stations, terrestrial, has increased to 15,500.
Wow. I wouldn't have thought that.
I wouldn't have either, but here's the caveat to that. And working for Curtis Media, I know why that number's gone up. We went in a binge of buying translators. Those are little FM translators. They can be anywhere from 5 to 200 watts. They take a signal of an AM station or an FM station, and it rebroadcasts it into a weak area or an area doesn't have it. So a lot of AM stations have purchased or are leasing these translators on FM because very, very honestly, not everyone's listening to AM radio. Very few do.
I was a big fan of AM radio back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day.
But you have manufacturers, and we talked about this 14 years ago. You have manufacturers that aren't putting AM in the cars anymore.
Right.
And that's still occurring. The future of terrestrial radio is probably the same as the future of podcasting, of Pandora, the largest streamer of over 2 million subscribers. And even to some degree, XM Sirius, they had just merged when we talked. They have 33 million subscribers. That's still only 10% of the population. So they didn't take over like the big fear. And you and I discussed that with what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I want everyone to look where AM and FM radio is right now. It is not in your home. You may have it out on your back porch. You may have a radio somewhere. You may listen to it streaming, which a lot are. 67% of people stream and listen online now. That's an unbelievable number to me.
Mm-hmm.
But let's take this next step further. Your car will be self-driving probably in 5 to 10 years, depending on how the technology rolls out. Let's go as far as 15 years. That's going to make your car an entertainment center now, complete.
Mm-hmm.
You set your course. Even if it's just on the interstates, you set your course. Now what do? The car with the passengers all around you, do the seats turn in? Do they go toward a screen? Do screens pop up? Everything's over the internet. Everything's 5G.
Mm-hmm.
That's biggie.
Mm-hmm.
It's here. It's going to replace your cable in your home. I hear silence.
I don't see where the radio fits in here.
Radio in your car could also transmit data.
Data's interesting.
Uh-huh.
That's interesting. But now, but what's
it's
what,
a lot. You need a lot.
Yeah, but why would I not just do it over the 5G network? Or is it going to be a conversion
that's
some of the radio towers?
That is the pipeline that brings it all in. You hit the main thing. The 5G or satellite in your car, all your terrestrial stations, all your podcasts, everything now, because all cars have this ability. Now you have those 30,000 channels. You have 300,000. You have 300 million channels. So terrestrial radio will still be there, probably in a streaming form, when you want to know what's happening locally. But there's a caveat to that as well.
Mm.
And that is the consolidation of operations of radio now, terrestrial radio, where you have no staff in a building. You may have 8 stations. Your morning show is syndicated from somewhere else. Your news, your traffic, your weather are coming from somewhere else. All the programming, all the music is coming from somewhere else. What has happened is that what we feared with Sirius XM of dominating and just playing music, that the big companies, iHeart in particular, are now doing that. You can go up and down the dial as you travel, and you're going to hear the same song playing on this station as playing on the next station up the road as playing on the next station up the road.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere terrestrial radio is going to have to become important to tune into. But when it comes to traveling the car, it's going to be more on the entertainment side.
And then you have the problem that a lot of people in the business, I mean, they used to have what's called a needle drop, right? And that was had multiple meanings. One was a payment program for every time you did a needle drop charge to the artist or the distributor. But it was truly a needle drop. You would put your needle on a record or, for that matter, maybe some other kind of cart. You had carts back in the day. Remember those?
Sure did.
Yep. You had carts, which are like kind of, I guess they were like 8-track kind of things.
They were like 8-tracks without the spindle in them, like an 8-track had. Right. The spindle was in the machine and popped up.
Right. And then you'd have all these things and you'd have to program. You'd have to bring in, bring out, you talk over. Now all that stuff can be programmed. I wouldn't be surprised if there would be some kind of artificial voice in the future. You're now listening to WPBB in Tennessee, you know, somebody that has all these things recorded ahead of time. Which they probably
you don't. Have it on the Weather Channel already.
Yeah, that's true. I hate that voice.
That's Jim Cantore, of all people.
Terrible.
But it's not great. But National Weather Service is even worse. it's the technology is there. The AI is there. It hasn't happened yet. I think to some degree that iHeart and some of these larger companies, and there aren't as many as it used to be, are mirroring what XM Sirius did to so they don't lose those people to the subscribers. I think there's different types of people that listen to radio, the people who would never subscribe, the people who might if the price is right, and those who just absolutely love it. And that's great. And that creates diversity in the market. My center where I'm looking goes back to that car and how can AM FM radio use their signals to somehow they're going to be online. There's all the programming could be online straight out. So what do you do with that transmitter? Can you make it into a database delivery system? They did do it with some of the television frequencies, and they did do it with the lower end of the FM band, which was shared with television.
But then you still have the content problem. You still have the content problem.
Yeah. And that's the podcast. That's where your podcast
is. Yeah, you got the podcast that replaced AM radio, let's be honest. You have XM Sirius that replaced – if I can go and I want to listen to, say, 80s, 70s, 60s, you know, I don't know what I'm going to get. You know, the FM dial here in Florida, you got bebop and rap and maybe one rock station that's kind of halfway. But if I want to listen to, I don't know, the Bruce Springsteen-like channel, I can just do that. If I want to listen to 60s, I can do that with one push of a button. And even that, it's overwhelming what's on there right now. So a lot of work to do in the terrestrial radio. The good thing is you retired. Because I don't have a lot of hope for it, frankly. I just don't. And it's not because there's anything bad about it, because other things have replaced it. You know, it's a buggy whip discussion.
That's a really, really good point. There are so many options now. And again, this is a 14th anniversary show. So we go back, and I mentioned, if you like Elephant Stampede music, and if you remember that little joke I made, well, by George, you can find that now on one of those 300 million channels that you just talked about.
Right.
The diversity is unbelievable. I want to go to podcasts real quick here, though. You made you were a pioneer in this. You really, really were. I don't know if you understand how early you were on this. I later in 2012, 13, 14, 15 – did a national syndicated show with the folks over at Mr. Food.
Yeah.
And it started off as an hour long podcast. You know, if the podcast people were going, what do you do an hour? What do you mean an hour? You shouldn't do an hour. I did that on purpose because it became an hour long radio show. So we were feeding the 100 million people who click on MrFood.com. They were able to get this show and our radio affiliates were there as well. So we were able to combine the two.
By the way, that's how we got together. Cause I think I had a friend named Chuck Ginsburg. His dad was Mr. Food. Yeah. I think he passed away, if I'm not mistaken.
He did in 2012. Right. Art passed.
Yep. Art Ginsburg. And,
Art, what a great guy. It's funny that we have a rotating electronic, you know, digital picture frame, and a picture came up of Susie and Art and I together. The last time we saw him was just before he passed. But the show goes on, and the crew is still baking in the test kitchen, and They're doing their thing. And that is how we met. That's exactly how.
Yep. I forgot about that.
No, I did too. Do you mention it?
That's great. Hey, listen. So listen, I wish you the best of everything. We want to just do this quick, short stint as a kind of a throwback to the good old days. And I appreciate all the things that you've done for the industry as well. And I really do appreciate you coming on, talking about some of the future and the outlook and all that. So let's do it again in 5 years.
I would love to do that. Let me brag for 1 second before we go.
Sure.
I was 1 month shy of 50 years in this
wow.
industry.
Wow.
And what hurts me, though, is I'm seeing a lot of my friends now. There's been another round of layoffs with the big company. Mm. And it hurts me to see folks who have put in 25, 30, 35, 40 years get cut and there's nowhere to go. The jobs aren't there anymore for them.
Well, especially because it's so easy to just do this on a shoestring. I mean, I'm a member of a variety of different groups that are like, you know, podcasting, whatever, just kind of, you know. And everybody has a podcast, number one. Number two, what do you need? You don't even need, listen, if you want some good equipment, let's say you're going to spend $1,000, you're all set to go. Let's say you don't want good equipment. Let's say you just want a microphone, a USB microphone. What is it going to cost you, $100 maybe?
Then you know, get it cheaper than that, yeah.
Yeah, you plug it into a Mac and you put your GarageBand on and you just kind of do your thing. Now, you're not going to have the best sound, the best quality. You're not going to have different jingles and things and whatever, but okay. Better yet, how about this? You don't even need to do that. Just put in your headphones from your phone into a computer and just go live stream on YouTube. I mean, and by the way, much of this is crap. I watch some of this stuff and I'm like, oh, what? And I watch only because it's the same way that I watch a horrible accident on the street. Okay.
Yes.
It's like, I don't want to see this. I can't, but I can't stop watching.
I can't turn my eyes away.
Right.
You can't take my eyes off.
It was like the Chevy Chase show. Remember that one? It's like, oh, this is terrible. This is hard, but I can't stop watching. I need to see how bad it's going to get. But yeah.
You knew it wasn't going to go anywhere, but you had to watch to see how far down it was going to go.
Exactly. Brian Freeman, hey, I appreciate you coming on board. Thanks for celebrating our 14th with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, Andrew.
Now we're going to work our way right into our next guest. Before I do so, I want to mention our great sponsor, Interactive Brokers, because, a lot of people are looking for extra money, a little extra income, and they have a way for you to do that because Interactive Brokers has something called the Stock Yield Enhancement Program, SYEP. And what it does is it lets you earn extra income on fully paid shares of stock in your brokerage account. So here's basically how it works. Interactive Brokers will lend your shares that are held inside of your account to traders who pay interest to borrow them. And you receive 50% of the income earned. It's that simple. You open an Interactive Brokers account today, you start earning income right away on qualifying shares. You can learn more about this at ibkr.com/SYEP. Kind of an interesting way to make a little bit more money inside of your portfolio beyond what is going on with your holdings. So why not check it out? Again, it's ibkr.com/SYEP. And back with us today is our good friend Vitaly Katsinelson from, he has a writer. He writes what's called Contrarian Edge. And he is the chief investment officer at Investment Management Associates, better known as IMA, which is a value investment firm in Denver, Colorado. He graduated with degrees in finance at the University of Colorado and also has a CFA designation. So this is one smart cookie that we have with us today. Vitaly, how you been, buddy?
It's great. It's my pleasure. I always enjoy doing your show. You're phenomenal.
Thanks. Did you know, by the way, not everybody knows this, so I'm catching everybody up to this, that we are the longest running financial and investing podcast that started back in 2007?
I can see why. I mean, you're so good. I really mean it. I really enjoy doing it. You're a phenomenal host.
I appreciate it. Now, you do a lot of writing, and you do a lot of great writing, a lot of, you know, descriptive and kind of bring a lot of other areas. And I know you're a big fan of classical music, and you wrap in some of your discussions in those kinds of terms. You've written for, Financial Times and Barron's and Business Week and all that. And recently, you wrote a few things I want to talk about. But one of the things that you do talk about quite often is, and I don't know if it's, you know, maybe it's defensive in a way in some of these environments, but, you know, you write about value investing, the concept of value investing. We've talked about it before. And I thought, though, for the audience today and everybody listening that really maybe started investing recently that doesn't know what the hell's in value, what is that? How can we actually define value investing to them?
So let me give you a wrong definition first.
Okay.
Okay. Buying cheap stocks.
Okay.
Okay. Or even more wrong, buying statistically cheap stocks.
Now, cheap is two different definitions, right? Cheap is like, okay, it's 30 cents. And cheap is that it is cheap to its peers.
Well, no, so both. I give you both that are wrong so far. So far, both are wrong. Let me give you the right definition. It's a philosophy where you have certain tenants. Like, you know, let me give you one. That you want to buy companies that are significantly undervalued. Okay. Number two, you treat stocks as businesses, not pieces of paper. Number three, the volatility is there to certain, you know, your true risk is not really volatility, what, you know, how the stock market decides to price a company in any specific day, but permanent loss of capital. When the stock price declines, it never comes back because the business, the value of the business has declined. Number four, you have a long-term time horizon. So your time horizon is not weeks or, you know, weeks or months, but years. And that, again, that's going back to the fact that you're treating the companies you're buying, the stocks you're buying, not as pieces of paper, but as businesses. In other words, you're analyzing the same way you and I would be analyzing if you were buying a private company. And there are a few more, but this is kind of, but these are kind of the tenets of value investing. And they have absolutely nothing to do with buying statistically cheap stocks. And I think this is kind of, when people read in the Intelligent Investor, you know, kind of the Bible of value investing.
Mm-hmm. Benjamin Graham?
Benjamin Graham, exactly. They can get two things out of it. A lot of people just get out, you know, that, you know, you got to buy stocks at less 10 times earnings. Or it's almost like going to the, you know, to Louvre and figuring out that they have soft paper towels in their bathroom kind of thing. That's basically, if you read this book and that's all you get out of it, that's basically, that's, it's kind of that, kind of, you know, it's kind of, that's a very primitive insight. It's like missing the whole framework. Point.
So let's go back, though. Let's go back. So the first thing you said, you have to have a long time horizon. That's the last thing you said, right? So that flies right in the face with the Adderall investor that we have right now, right? Yeah. And people that are looking to, hey, I'm going to buy this stock and 3 days later, or very quickly, it's going to go up in value and stay up there. The other thing you talked about was how you're buying a company, not just a piece of paper. And that flies into the face of the investor just looking for the quick hit on looking at not the business itself, but who cares about the business as long as it makes money, price is what pays. And you know what? Jim Cramer says it, and I'm going to buy it, right? And then the other things you talk about, you know, looking at value of it in terms of not statistically, but you know, looking at it as a company and would I want this for the long haul, is just not kind of the game right now. Would you agree with those points?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I agree with you wholeheartedly because the couple of things. Number one, I think people look at the stock market and just because you're buying stock doesn't mean you're investing. And I think I would argue stock market is a lot more dangerous than Las Vegas to some, you know, because the stock market could either be like a place where you invest or a place where you gamble. Okay. But here's the thing, because people, when they buy stocks, they think they're investing. They may end up losing a lot more money because when you go into Las Vegas, if you have an IQ above a potato, you know that, you know, that, you know, there's a good chance you're going to lose all this money. But in fact, the odds are against you that you're going to come back with more money than you came with. Mm-hmm. So then you came there to be, okay. But because when you're buying, I don't know, pick a company, because you buy Netflix and the day before you watch show on Netflix, now you think you're investing. that's, you know, if you're just buying it and treating it as a piece of paper, you're just gambling with your life savings.
That's like, so, that's like going past a stop sign and it's red, walking into a casino, going to the roulette table, say, hey, I saw a red sign. I'm going to put it on red. It must be lucky.
Exactly. Except when you go, when you do this with $100 in Las Vegas, you know the concept, you will, if you are having, you know, again, you would probably not take your life savings and put it on red, right? But because people often confuse stock market with a casino, and so and they treat it like a casino, and they take the life savings and put it on red, and then they wake up, they buy GameStop, and then one day they wake up and found out that they bought something, you know, paid $300 for something that's worth $5.
But then again, on the other hand, there is the Peter Lynch strategy, which is buy what you know, right? And it's like, okay, this is, I think there's some truth to this, by the way. Okay, I like, I'm just going to make some things up here. I watch Netflix, and I think I like Netflix, yeah. And I would never cancel my Netflix, and they can inch me up a dollar here or there, and I'm going to stay. Yeah. Or, you know, I use Microsoft as all my products. Or I have Apple. I love my iPhone. Now, what I think about that is not just, okay, I like it. No, probably I'm the man on the street. I'm the everyday guy. I'm doing everything that everybody else is doing. Not much different. And if I'm doing it and I have a preference towards it, unless it's something really, you know, a very niche kind of situation, probably everybody else is doing the same thing.
Yeah. So let me give you an example. Let's say there is a restaurant right next to a house. And you go to that restaurant and you have this incredible meal. And you say, my God, this place must be awesome. Okay. And I want to own it. And then you say, I'm going to write a check for $500 million for this restaurant to own it. Would you do that? Just one restaurant? That would be silly, right? That would be insane. Right. No matter, like, you know, they really have to have revenues.
Well, on the data, on the data you provided me just now, no, the answer is no.
There's not enough data
to go buy anything.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's just, you know, $500 million is a lot of money to pay for one location of a restaurant, no matter how great the food is, right?
Well, unless somehow it's they were doing $1 trillion worth of revenue.
Exactly. Okay. But again, it's just your mom and pop store. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we know that's insane. That would be insane. It's a mom and pop restaurant, let's say.
Right.
You know that's insane. So what I just showed you, that the price you pay, even for an incredible foie gras, whatever you are having in this restaurant, is matters, right?
Right.
So the same thing happens with the stock market. So a company may have an incredible product, and which is, this is great. That's, knowing that company has a great, incredible product is important. But you also need to know what is this company maybe worth, because again, just like as a paying $500 million for a restaurant, mom and pop restaurant, is insane. Maybe paying $50 billion for a company that has revenues of, you know, $50 million is insane as well. And if you look today, and I don't have a concrete example to show you, but if you look at a lot of stocks that are today that are trade, like, you know, if you look at GameStop, that is an insanity.
Let's not.
Well, that's not. But you know what I mean. So if you look,
well, let me give you this though. Let me throw this at you.
Yeah.
So the mom and pop situation that you described to me is, you know, a little bit absurd and all that. But what investors are doing right now is they're taking and saying, well, you know what? No, I wouldn't pay $500 million for a mom and pop restaurant. But the mom and pop restaurant has a, quote, path to profitability, because they put this in a white paper, and they're going to open up, you know, one in every town in the U.S. And we believe, because when they do that, they're going to grow substantially and they can extrapolate. That's what's going on in the markets now. This gigantic game of extrapolation to say that this is going to be something bigger. And you know what? Why wait to pay for it when it's so much bigger, when I can get onto it now? Isn't that what's happening?
Well, that's right. But the thing is, you know, can you imagine what this store has to do, like in this example, to, you know, how many stores they have to open for to justify this valuation? And that future, how perfect it has to be. The point I'm trying to make is this: when you look at this, you know, when you look at it as buying the whole business, suddenly saying $500 million for a company that generates revenue in millions maybe is insane. But let me give you this example, and I just literally pulled it up while we were talking, just to give you an example.
All right.
There's a company, and again, I have no skin in the game. I don't own the company. The only thing we use their service as in QuickBooks. It's a bill.com. So this is a company that has revenues of $160 million, And this is a company that has a market capitalization of $12.7 billion. So this, let me ask a question. Would you pay $12.7 billion for a company that's even fast growing, that has revenues of $167 million? That is, now that's almost 100 times revenues.
Right.
So you'll say, probably I wouldn't. But here's the thing. If you look at it, if you just keep, if you just look at it as a piece of paper, as a stock, and say, well, Bill.com, I love this service, but it's $154 stock. Okay, you know, I should buy it. Do you see the difference?
I'm clear about this, but the problem is that you're not getting reward. Well, let me say this. Let me say it differently. Let me turn this upside down. You're getting rewarded right now to buy those kinds of things. Now, I realize that there may be a catastrophe in the future, but you know what? Over the last 2 years, doing the job of an analyst, of doing the breakdown of the company, of looking at all the different functions and statistics, looking at the valuations and all that, I got to tell you, my friend, it's been freaking lonely, hasn't it?
It is. And it's like, I wrote a few articles on this topic and comparing it to kind of 1999 money. Like in a sense, in 99, the more you knew about investing, the less money you made, right?
right.
And it's kind of the same, right? It's going on right now because it's a, and this is a kind of a bigger point, but I think what's happening in the stock market is a manifestation. And you're also seeing it just not in the market, but also in real estate. You're seeing it like I have a friend who owns a trading cards store, and he has the best year he ever had.
I heard there are some crazy prices right now for baseball cards and other playing cards.
And that's what I would argue is just a manifestation of speculation and this is an important point, inflation that is making into assets. And at some point that will make it, you know, so right now it's not showing up in the price of your tomatoes, but at some point it will.
The other thing is that people are numb to the cost of things, right? Like I could tell you, I know, and I can tell you, listen, I've been at this a long time, and I'll tell you something personally that, you know, there are times that I just do my thing and I kind of throw my credit card down on a meal or something, or better yet, you know, I'm out somewhere and I'll buy something. And there's those moments that I just don't even care what it costs. I know that sounds kind of really disgusting, but I'm sorry to say that we all have those moments, right? It's like, all right, whatever it is, you know, I'm not going to, you know, this other thing I may be really like, all right, let me get the best price on this because I need this. There's other things that are like, okay, you know what? Let me get there. I think the pandemic has created situations like, all right, I just went through a near-death experience. I'm probably having post-virus stress disorder where I'm nervous about going out and doing things, but I'm out already. Let me just live a little bit because you know what? Who knows? I keep on hearing these words, variant and mutations, and I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So what am I waiting for? I think there's a lot of that in the environment right now.
No, I think you're right. Actually, I think she coined this term PVSD. I think a lot of it going on. But it's the speculation you've seen in the stock market in general right now is that when people keep making money, they think their time horizon is extremely long, right? They're like, oh, I'm buying this company. It's trading at $13 billion. But you know what? In 30 years, this company is going to have this revenues, etc. The problem is this time horizon right now is infinite. It will shrink very quickly when this company is down 30%.
Yeah. So let me just get back to this, though, that value plays traditionally when you look at it and split the market, and especially when you're looking at ETFs and looking at sector styles and all this. Usually the value is usually considered the banks, the energies, the staples, whereas the growth is your technology, maybe consumer discretionary, healthcare. Is that how you look at it? Or are there those times that you'll find a technology company? I think there was a time when IBM was on your list as hot, right? Or HP.
HP. I think beyond HP.
But my point is that kind of situation where there's a value, does that sometimes make you nervous when you see value in, let's say, a growth stock that becomes a quote-unquote value stock? Does that make you nervous that could be dead money moving forward?
Yeah, so there's several answers to this. Number one, remember how I started that statistically cheap stocks considered, you know, like that's, you know, there's this fallacy that, you know, this is value of growth based on where the price to earnings is today or price to sales. So I want to be very clear about this. So if when you have a computing power and you have a lot of companies and you are a consultant, what you're going to try to do, you're going to try to divide universes into different buckets. You're going to have a growth bucket, you're going to have a value bucket. And how do you do this? Well, you can't really do fundamental analysis in every company and say, this is a value stock. This company is undervalued, right? Because there's a lot of subjectivity to that. So what you do, you're going to say, I'm going to divide, let's say, S&P 500 on price to earnings. And I'm going to take the cheapest 250 companies, that's going to be our value bucket or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the most expensive 250 stocks, they're going to be our growth bucket. So when you hear value versus growth kind of conversation, that's what they're usually talking about. That's not how I characterize it. Mm-hmm. Here's why. So at some point, we owned Hewlett Packard when the stock was significantly undervalued to what I thought the company was worth.
So let's just stop there for a second. Hold on. So valuing the company against itself, where it could be, is the value equation, rather than necessarily valuing the company against statistically derived numbers of maybe a sector of its peers necessarily. Well, peers could come in, but of the sector itself or of the universe.
Yeah, so at the time, Hewlett Packard was significantly undervalued what I thought the present value of its future cash flows would,
worth. Right,
so
right.
You see, okay, see the difference. However, I'll give you a couple examples. So last year, like a year ago, we bought Uber, okay? And not a single consultant would put Uber into the kind of value category, right? Mm-hmm. But when we analyzed Uber, by the way, and this is, you can read my 15-page analysis on Uber, how I figured out that the company was undervalued on our website, and you can probably put it in the show notes if you'd like.
But here's
the point I want to stress: there is value in growth. In other words, when you look at a company, the value of any company is a present value of its future cash flows.
Right.
If a company, if you have a company whose cash flows are going to grow over the long term, for a full period of time, that company, that there's a lot of value in the cash flows that will make 3, 5, 10 years from now, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And so therefore, when we looked at Uber, we thought the company was undervalued because it was about to go from, this was before pandemic, we bought it a month before pandemic, mm-hmm. but it's still true for them today. It was going to go from the point where it was losing money to break even because it got to scale. And then at this point, they're going to start making a lot of money. And because once they're at scale, every dollar of revenue comes with very, very high margin, incremental margin. And in our analysis, we thought Uber was undervalued, even though I am a value investor. And even though Uber does not look statistically cheap based on earnings of 2020 or 2022, but on the earnings, we felt very strongly about of 2026, they were significantly undervalued.
Isn't that how a lot of people are valuing Tesla, though, in a way? They're looking at the future and looking at looking at it when it was maybe $300, $400, maybe even pre-split $400, and the stock just ran up. I mean, is it that same situation where you could look at a growth company potentially in the future? I mean, that it's kind of splitting hairs in a way, I think.
Well,
because is Uber profitable now? Is Uber profitable yet?
They basically going to be profitable by the end of this year, yes.
Right, they're going to be profitable by the end of this
year. They realized pandemic.
Yeah. Okay, pandemic, I'll give you the pandemic, but now their stock prices also ran up dramatically
That's right. And what's interesting, actually, and this is, by the way, this applies not just to Uber, but a lot of companies today. Pandemic may actually has benefited a lot of companies because it allowed them to take out costs, which they would have a hard time taking out when things were going well,
morally, that's why, because now they got
cover. Exactly. Right. Uber basically laid off one quarter of its workforce, which it had to do this because it was, it just got too fat. But it would have been very difficult internally politically to do this,
Now what they do is a lot of companies, this is interesting. This is an interesting point here because I want to explore this for you with you a second. Mm-hmm. I think our listeners really need to understand something here. What has happened during the pandemic has allowed for a lot of companies to do things that were probably considered like taboo. And then talk about how they're going to bring people back. But at the same time, run the business as efficiently as possible without that employee base, for example, or cost. So take, for example, a lot of companies have said, you know, we don't have to have all these people working in the office anymore. The savings of electricity for lighting and heating and cooling, yeah, for possibly lunches, the cost for office space itself, or maybe transportation that was paid for to the office, phone lines, people are using their cell phones, maybe there's a slight reimbursement, all these things. Yeah, they pick up some cost for Zoom and they pick up some cost for other things, but basically there's a tremendous amount of savings that really came into play here with this stay at home, and why some companies are like, you know what? Maybe we won't have all these people back to the office.
So I agree with you 100%, but let me take it looking from a slightly different perspective. Think about this. Before the pandemic, we were in the year 9 or 10, right, or something, over economic expansion.
Right.
We haven't had a recession in a long, long time. And recessions are basically kind of a cleansing mechanism where companies basically go on a diet and clean, you know, get rid of the extra fat. This pandemic was this kind of this super induced recession, right?
Yeah.
Which allowed them to kind of to slim very, very quickly. So when we come out of this, like if you look at Uber and let's say their revenues come back to pre-pandemic level, their earnings are going to be just much higher just because they took out costs. And you can take this example and basically across a lot of companies in the US and probably globally today. So that's point is extremely, extremely important, I think.
So how do I then go one step further here and look at something that's been kind of bugging me? There's a company called Planet Fitness. You know this company, Planet Fitness?
I know of them. They own gyms, right?
Right, yeah. So pandemic basically destroyed the company. The Peloton and gyms at home are crushing the chance for recovery. The earnings suck. Their outlook suck. Recently had earnings that were like not so good. Stock recently hit just at an all-time high. I mean, what kind of monkey is investing in this?
So I've been thinking a lot about this because what you really want to figure out if the pandemic has structurally changed our behavior in this category, right? So I'll give you one example, and this is full disclosure, we own the company, but I just want to walk you through our thinking about this. Mm-hmm. So we own a company, Tanger Outlets, which they own a lot of outlet malls, right? And so on one side, if you think about what pandemic did, it has moved a lot of sales online. At the same time, it has destroyed JCPenney, Macy's is shrinking their store count, a lot of stores going out of business. And so our thinking was, well, would Tanger benefit from pandemic, or has our behavior has changed and therefore they will get hurt by this? And what we figured out that in their case, in the case of Tanger, they're actually net beneficiary from this. Because in some cases, we're going to buy more things online. But in some cases, and this, you know, I can't, this is something that we'll never understand, but this is because I'm a male and I don't like going to stores, but I think some people really enjoy going to stores. And for them, that is their pastime. That is like for like, you know, some people
it's
like
me, it's like me at a buffet. Me going to a buffet.
Yes. You know, exactly. So some people like going. And so now if you are looking to buy brands, if you want to buy brands, the options the options are, the number of malls have shrunk, and number of department stores have shrunk. So now actually, I would argue in this case, Tanger may be a net beneficiary of this, even though at the same time, there will be more shopping done online. So right. I look at it case by case, and I'm questioning like, would we come back to movie theaters or not? And I really don't have a good answer for this. And I think this is one of those things that, maybe in 2 years, a year from now, that will normalize and we start going to movies again. Except if, and again, I
Yeah, cruises are a good example. Cruise lines and airlines are a really good example too. The same thing.
And I can't wait to travel.
I understand. I get it.
And so that behavior hasn't changed, right?
Right.
But at the same time, some of the business travel will probably go away because now you say I'll give an example. Perfect example. In the past, you have this investment houses put up this. Conferences, these conferences. Mm-hmm. In the past, all of them would be done in person, and I would argue maybe one third or half of them in the future will be done, through Zoom or etc. Because I found that actually the experience is actually even better.
Yeah, but the problem is you can't get the hookers and coke delivered. That's the problem.
Right?
Get
arguments there.
Yeah. Let me skip ahead to something here because you wrote another article called Covet Your Neighbor's Wife. And I'm not exactly sure, to be honest with you, when I read it, what I was supposed to get out of this, except unless you were being a little tricky and having me read between the lines here. And
there was no between the lines there at all.
Well, what I got out of it was kind of like FOMO in the markets. The whole idea of, you see something over there and you want it, but maybe you can't have it. But what you do is kind of like, I'm seeing everybody else do it, so I want it. I'm jealous of it. I'm going to go and I'm going to just invest. I don't know. Somehow I got twisted up in this. I don't know why.
Actually, it's kind of funny. It's I write probably one third of my articles now have absolutely nothing to do with the market. And this one, I had absolutely nothing to do with the market.
I made it something to do with the market because there are market lessons in everything, right? There are market lessons in everything we do.
And I'm sure there is a lesson there too, yes.
So what I'm saying is, it is kind of like this big FOMO environment right now where, yes, there is trend following and you can look at the energy stocks and other stocks and value and some of the things you're talking about that have come into play right now. But anyway, something there. All right, let me switch up. From a value investor standpoint, what's your take on crypto? Can you even for a second try to come up with a reason why it's good?
It's almost became like a crypto became a religion now. And having a discussion about it is that it's almost like there's no point. So here's how I look at this. If somebody wants to own it and put some tiny fraction of their net worth into it, that the amount they would be okay losing, I have no problem with that. As an investor, I have absolutely zero value to add there, except this. I can't own it because, and this is a true story, I had a friend who called me. He said, I have and this was 2 months ago, $1 million of Bitcoin. And he said, I put $600 into it 10 years ago, and now I have no idea what to do. Because if it declines, it would be a lot of money for me. But if I get out of it now, then what if it doubles?
Or taxes, yeah.
Yeah, and the irony of that was 2 months ago, and since then it's probably tripled. So I had no idea what to tell him. The same way I have no idea what to tell him now. So I just don't have I really don't have an insight. But can you go back to the neighbor's wife for a second?
Because I'm still covering her.
Yeah. No, let me tell you the story. So this is what happened. I was talking to a good friend of mine, and we had this kind of deep conversation. And I asked him, would you want to have Warren Buffett's success? He said, is that a rhetorical question? I said, no. He said, yes, of course I would. You and I are Jewish, and my wife is very deeply religious, and she told me this story, which I thought was phenomenal. It's I'm not getting too philosophical, but in a Jewish religion, they have this concept where if you're gonna basically jealous of something or what somebody else has, mm-hmm. you want to do it in entirety. In other words, if you have this, if your neighbor has this beautiful wife that you really admire from afar, and you really want to covet her, do it in the entirety. In other words, imagine that wife comes with a mother who is gonna, every time you see her, she wants to keep you on the lips, and with a brother who probably spends every other week in jail, and that wife is gonna pay a lot less attention to you than you think. Mm-hmm. All this, so after you imagine all this, do you still have, you know, so in other words, if you cover it, do it in entirety.
Right. So just don't do it after her body, but think about, hey, you're going to have to adopt her kids. You're going to have to deal with the mother-in-law, you know, and she's going to want all these Birkin bags. She's going to want to buy and all the diamonds. And is that what you want before you make the final decision?
After you do this, you may not want to cover it as much, right?
Which means, and that translates in, if the work Buffett has to do and all that, maybe I don't want that success.
Exactly. And then the case with Buffett was kind of interesting because his success came at an incredible personal cost. And this is what I was talking about. His wife, you know, and this is, you know, when I read the Snowball by Alice Schroeder, that book had such a huge impact. It's a kind of authorized biography on Buffett, right? Because basically he gave you access to everything. See, he allowed all of his friends to talk to her, etc. And this book, you know, I'm this diehard value investor. I read this, you know, I read this 500-page book about Buffett. And the most important point I got out of this is not to be like Buffett.
Mm-hmm.
And because his wife, who was the love of his life, left him. And his kids basically, at the end of his life, he felt like he didn't spend enough time with his kids.
Yeah, a little late.
Lately, in his 70s, I guess, 80s. But, he did not know about this at the time. Because basically, he dedicated all his life to investing. And he was an absent father, an absent husband. And that's when I say, when you look at Buffett and his success, I say, look at this entirety. Do you really want to have $100 billion that you're going to give away anyway? Or that he's going to give away anyway, even if you don't, at this cost? And that was really the point of the article to me.
Which I think, by the way, has been further cemented in by this, by the pandemic and the realization of, is there more to life? You know?
That's exactly right.
So,
Andrew, I'm right. It's kind of just, and then we can switch to a different topic, but I was going to tell you, I'm right. I'm just finishing a book right now. And it's going to come out in August.
Oh.
It's called Soul in the Game.
Soul in the Game.
Soul in the Game. And this book does not have a single article about it. This book is completely not about investing.
And it's not about sneakers with Nike. It's S-O-U-L, not S-O-L-E.
This is my beautiful Russian accent. Yeah, Soul in the Game. But the point I'm trying to make is that, to me, non-investment topics like what you and I just talked about are as dear to me now, and maybe as I got older, than, kind of the value investing.
Yeah, I hear you. We got to wrap it. Vitaly Katsanelson, we're going to put all the information on the website. I know you have a great newsletter. You have a great following. We're going to put all the information on how to get in touch with you, all the information. And of course, once the book comes out, let me know. Please send me a copy. We will catch up on the other side of that so I can take a look and discuss the idea that you have and some of the other ideas you have in the future. I really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much. Again, you're phenomenal.
Thanks. You too, buddy. Thanks. How nice is Vitaly with those compliments? That makes me feel really good. Hey, listen, it's been 14 years. It's been 707 shows, hardly ever missing a week. Bringing on some of the best. I think we've had over 400 guests on the show, maybe 375, give or take. It's the longest running independent financial and investing podcast that started as a podcast. We're not talking about just a radio show they started putting out on the podcast networks. We're talking about homegrown from the beginning, doing what we do to help you become a much more disciplined investor, working on your future, your financial security. That's what it's all about. Thank you, everybody, for joining me over these years. Thank you so much for being there. We have a lot more to come, a lot more great guests, and we're looking forward to another 14 years. That would be something, wouldn't it? Listen, thanks so much. Have a great week. I'll see you again right around the block on episode number 708. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.